This is Christy Westfall for Health Styles Radio, brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy via Hunter College. April is Child Abuse Awareness Month. To commemorate, I've pieced together a few special edition segments, or tales from the cribs, if you will. Shaken baby syndrome and abusive head trauma remain among the most controversial diagnoses in pediatric healthcare. I was recently flipping through the sea of news apps when I was drawn into yet another article refuting the science behind the diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome. Curiosity pulled me in, and further internet surfing revealed little science and lots of speculation on the topic. Non-accidental trauma, inflicted head injuries, blunt head trauma, shaken baby syndrome, abusive head trauma. It can be challenging for anyone to navigate all of these definitions. Rather than quibble over confusing press, I challenge you to take a few minutes from your day to stop, breathe, yes, we're talking child abuse here, and refocus on the fact that abusive head trauma remains a leading cause of disability, devastation, and death in young children. Welcome to Tales from the Cribs, a down-and-dirty analysis of the truths behind shaken baby syndrome and abusive head trauma. Let's head in with a little history, shall we? The defined concept of child abuse is credited to a French forensic physician back in the 19th century. It wasn't until the 1940s that research evolved to further explore this concept. American radiologist John Caffey identified a correlation between long bone fractures and chronic head bleeds, also known as subdural hemorrhages, back in 1946. Caffey continued his research, and two neurosurgeons also jumped on the bandwagon and began to make some very interesting observations. Neurosurgeon Ayub Omaya took a closer look at 40 miles per hour induced whiplash forces on rhesus monkeys. Pediatric neurosurgeon Norman Gulfkelch noticed that many of his young patients with bleeding in their brains also had bleeding behind their eyes. He then went on to coin the phrase, whiplash shaken infant syndrome. Starting to sound a little more familiar, well, Kempe et al. Coined the phrase battered child syndrome in 1962, which then led to Ludwig and Warman's advent of the term that many of us still hear quite commonly today, shaken baby syndrome. So, how does one exactly define this syndrome? Well, technically, it's a constellation of medical findings that are associated with shaking and is considered a form of child physical abuse. These findings include retinal hemorrhages or bleeding in the behind the surface of the eyes, subdural hemorrhages or bleeding around the brain or in the brain, as well as cerebral edema or swelling of the brain. The body of research surrounding these intentional pediatric head injuries continued to evolve further, and then healthcare providers began to become increasingly aware that a diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome may hold some significant limitations, especially since not all head injuries in children are necessarily associated with shaking. It became clear that a better definition was in order. A summit of experts and 40 years of multidisciplinary research has led the healthcare community to a better way to describe inflicted head injuries in children. Please join us in using this term, abusive head trauma. Defined as an injury to the skull or intracranial contents of an infant or young child due to inflicted blunt impact and/or violent shaking, abusive head trauma is responsible for quite the drama. Statistically speaking, approximately 1,200 serious deaths and at least 80 preventable deaths per year. Statistically speaking, approximately 1,200 serious injuries and at least 80 preventable deaths per year can be attributed to abusive head trauma. Healthcare providers prefer this term as opposed to shaken baby syndrome, as it gives us the ability to explore multiple avenues involving a potential injury versus placing a label that implies a solidary shaking mechanism. The biggest truth behind abusive head trauma in kids is that it's largely preventable. Thank you for joining us in this segment commemorating April as National Child Abuse Awareness Month, and stay tuned as this next Tale from the Crib segment will focus on injury information and prevention pearls. Together, we can make a difference. Welcome back to Health Styles Radio. This is Christy Westfall, pediatric nurse practitioner and senior fellow for the Center of Health Media Policy at Hunter College. April is National Child Abuse Awareness Month. If you're just joining the buzz, today's Tale from the Cribs is a focused discussion of shaken baby syndrome versus abusive head trauma. Which term should we use and why? We've reviewed the historic progression from battered child syndrome to whiplash shaken infant syndrome to the well-known moniker shaken baby syndrome. However, abusive head trauma is now replacing shaken baby syndrome in the healthcare arena. Defined as child physical abuse that results in an injury to the head or brain, abusive head trauma is a common cause of devastating neurologic injuries in children. 15 to 23% of the victims of pediatric abusive head trauma die within hours to days of the initial injury. Of those who survive, 1/3 of the children suffer severe disability, 1/3 moderate deficits, and 1/3 mild symptoms with little or no long-term effects. 2/3 of all victims of pediatric abusive head trauma will survive, only to suffer. They suffer significant neurologic, cognitive, and behavior impairments. So, what does that mean? What exactly does survival from abusive head trauma look like in a child? Let's break it down. No pun intended. Children may suffer partial or total loss of hearing or vision, speech impairments, seizure disorders, impaired intelligence, difficulty concentrating, developmental delays, and they may even need to have feeding tubes to help them eat or breathing tubes placed to help them breathe. A mom once asked me if her baby would be okay after her husband did confess to shaking him. The baby was still breathing and moving, therefore, did that mean he would be okay in the long run? I had to give her my honest response, which was, I don't know. Seemingly mild cases of abusive head trauma can be tricky because an infant with mild to moderate brain damage can still continue to do fairly normal baby things, like cry, eat, pee, poo, breathe. Unfortunately, we have to wait for infants to grow up before we can actually start to track deficits or long-term problems. The American Academy of Pediatrics actually does a phenomenal job of clearly defining the injuries that we see in young children who suffer from traumatic brain injuries from abusive head trauma. Children may have collections of bleeding in or around the surface of the brain, injuries to the structures of the brain, swelling of the brain, and 85% of children with abusive head trauma may have bleeding to the back portion of their eyes, also known as retinal hemorrhages. So, evidence of direct or blunt trauma to the head, which can include skull fractures, bumps, bruises, or other wounds, and victims may also have other signs or symptoms from physical abuse, including new or old broken bones, signs of intra-abdominal injuries, or other wounds or injuries. As a pediatric nurse practitioner, one of my most important jobs, and one of my favorite jobs, is educating families. Returning back to the mother who asked me about the outcomes for her injured infant, she wanted to understand more about the injuries and about her baby's brain. I could have gone all jargon on her and said, the pathophysiology of abusive head trauma includes both acceleration-deceleration forces and or blunt trauma. This includes bridging veins rupture, causing intracranial hemorrhages. Neurons are damaged and release chemicals called neurons, and this process leads to a vicious cycle of hypoxia, cerebral edema, and increased intracranial pressure. Nurse practitioner said, what? Yeah, didn't say that. The great thing about being a PNP is that we have skills. We can take complex medical terms and translate it down to make it real for parents and families and not just a quote out of a science journal or a magazine. When I teach families about head injuries, I emphasize the weight of the matter. Babies have big heads and little bodies. I can't claim full credit for this quote. My siblings would relentlessly taunt me with it during childhood. After one fateful evening when we were all looking at our baby pictures, they found one of me, big head, little body. It still sticks today. However, it's true. Babies do have big heads. They have weak neck muscles, and they're disproportionate to their little bodies. Understanding that babies have heavy heads explains why they tend to land on them after a fall. Thank you, gravity. Understanding the weak neck muscles explains why shaking a baby is dangerous. They're unable to self-support their heads. It's also key to give parents a heads up about baby brains. Helps them to understand the implications behind a potential brain injury. An infant's brain doubles in size during the first 6 months of life and will achieve up to 80% of its adult brain by 2 years of age. Baby brains are also very soft, They move a lot, and they're more gelatinous than that of adult. They're also much higher in water content than that of an adult brain. Imagine a peeled orange. The brain is like that peeled orange, tucked away in a bath of cerebral spinal fluid, covered with a comfortable blanket of vascular and meninges, and then has a nice, hard skull to help keep it safe. As shaking occurs, that orange is forced to move back and forth inside of the skull. The blankets of tissue and blood vessels can become disturbed or tear. If the shaking is violent enough, the orange will bump into the skull, or the brain will bump into the skull, with multiple directions, causing direct trauma to the brain tissue. Similar injury can occur if a child experiences direct trauma to the head from being tossed on the floor, flung against a wall, or even beaten. Eating an orange may now evoke new imagery. Even though the term shaken baby syndrome still circulates through the courtroom and press, healthcare experts continue to agree that abusive head trauma offers the best definition for head and brain injuries due to child physical abuse. Defined as an injury to the skull or intracranial contents due to inflicted blunt trauma, or shaking, abusive head trauma is a leading cause of disability, devastation, and death in our young children. Abusive head trauma is also preventable. Are there parent and child characteristics that increase the risk for child abuse? The research says yes! Infants who frequently are fussy and cry constantly are known to be at risk for abusive head trauma due to the association with high levels of parental stress and frustration. Other infants high at risk for abusive head trauma include children with colic, gastroesophageal reflux, premature infants, or children with special needs or developmental delays. Child abuse spares no socioeconomic or cultural background, which makes predictability impossible. Look around you. Child abuser is never written on somebody's face. There is no way to tell just by looking who would or who wouldn't hurt a child, intentionally or unintentionally. Where there is no scarlet letter for child abuse, well, scarlet letter no. Red flags associated with perpetrator characteristics? Why yes! Some of those red flags include a personal history of abuse or exposure to domestic violence. A parent may have mental illness, substance abuse, or addiction challenges. They may live in a very poor community or suffer from poverty. They may also be extremely socially isolated and have poor support systems. The best way for us to work together as a society to cure abusive head trauma in infants and children is to prevent it from happening in the first place. Those who have clinically worked with me know my token phrase well, eternally optimistic, and I truly am. While research has provided a laundry list of red flags and risks, it's also been very successful in identifying some of the family protective factors that can negate the negative influences that could predispose abusive head trauma. Rather than point my finger at a particular family or individual who may seem to exhibit multiple risk factors with no current evidence of an injured infant, I choose to identify positive family resilience factors, encourage families to play on their strengths, and provide need-based resource information. Some of these protective family resilience factors include access to healthcare, parental employment, involvement in a supportive community, and strong family communication and stability within the family. Also golden is the prevention and teaching of anticipatory guidance provided to parents during their regular healthcare visits. Teaching parenting skills such as limit setting, discipline, and normal expectations can help parents to set up to succeed. We want to help them to succeed in raising healthy families. As a pediatric nurse practitioner, I love empowering my families to make excellent choices to promote optimal family health. When providing anticipatory guidance for head trauma, I screen for both risk and resilience factors, and then I focus in on the scream. Crying is highly associated with abusive head trauma. A fussy infant won't stop fussing. The caregiver can't console the child. Frustration ensues, which is then followed by escalating anger and potential injury to the infant by way of shaking, blunt impact, or both. You don't speak, baby? You're not alone. Here's the 411 that I provide to my families about crying. First of all, crying is normal. It's how babies communicate. Crying is not a reflection of parenting failure. Crying may increase from birth until about 6 weeks of life and does tend to increase in the later afternoon and evening hours. Infants can't learn social behaviors. They're not little adults. All parents and caregivers can get frustrated with crying, so it's important to be prepared and stage interventions ahead of time, such as phoning a friend or having a timeout set up. Also, teach everyone that a crying baby should never, ever be disciplined by forceful shaking or throwing. Many parents also want to know if any of the everyday activities such as driving, jogging, bouncing a baby on a knee, or even tossing them in the air while playing can cause injuries, shaking injuries potentially. I had a mother who is a member of a jogging group where she has her little Bob in her stroller and all the ladies go jogging with their babies. The answer is no. However, I do strongly advocate for safety here, and I recommend appropriate safety restraints for all traveling modalities in infants. I exercise extreme caution with cycling because if you're on a bike, babies behind you, there are cars. It's just not the most safe position to put a child in. I'm also not a super fan of the tossing the baby into the air game. While it may seem fun, can be potentially dangerous. With that being said, individual education, super important, so important that many states have now implemented educational programs to help stop abusive head trauma. Two of my favorites are Barr's Period of Purple Crying and Diaz's New York Experience. Both are strong educational programs with extremely strong supportive research evidence that they actually work. The tragedy of abusive head trauma in children has huge implications on an individual, family, and societal level. 1,200 children sustain serious injuries and 800 die per year from abusive head trauma. It can happen so quickly. Just 3 seconds of shaking can be fatal or cause lifelong disability and devastation. Defined as injury to the skull or intracranial contents of an infant or young child due to inflicted impact or shaking, the healthcare community prefers the use of abusive head trauma as opposed to shaken baby syndrome due to its more comprehensive definition. We know that continuous crying and caregiver frustration are the main reasons why caregivers shake, hit, or throw their babies. We also know that providing families with resources such as access to healthcare providers, fostering a supportive community for them, assisting with housing or caregiver employment, and also teaching caregivers about discipline, limit setting, and crying can help protect against abusive head trauma. So people, abusive head trauma is preventable. We have a saying at Rady Children's Hospital, the power of one, and I believe in it. Each of us have the capacity to change the world, and by knowing these risk and resilience factors for abusive head trauma, you now have the tools to save lives. Baby brains should not be bumped, bruised, battered, shaken, or stirred as disability, devastation, or death can occur. Breathe, soothe, or step away. Allow your baby to cry and live another day. This is Christy Westfall, PNP by the Sea, for Health Styles Radio, brought to you by the Center of Health and Media Policy at Hunter College. Thank you again for taking the time to listen to my Tale from the Crib, a discussion / exploration of the terminology shaken baby syndrome versus abusive head trauma. April remains National Child Abuse Awareness Month. Let's continue to work together to end child abuse. For additional information on abusive head trauma and shaken baby syndrome, I recommend www.don'tshake.org, the National Child Traumatic Stress Network at www.nctsn.org, any of the resources by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the World Health Organization. And I must give a shout out to a fantastic website that gives a compilation of articles that highlight abusive head trauma outcomes, and that can be found on the website for the Meyerson Center for Safe and Health Children out of Cincinnati Children's.
Hi, this is Barbara Gleickstein. Diana Mason and I co-host Health Styles. Here's my ask. Please become a BAI buddy. It's only 33 cents a day, and that math equals $10 a month, and you're going to be supporting your station. Why don't you become one of us? Become that activist global citizen making a difference in the world every day, and just for 33 cents. We've been around for quite a while here at WBAI, and we think this is an awesome new idea. So please join us and become a BAI buddy. Go to WBAI.org and sign up. And thank you.
This is Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned into Health Styles, produced by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College. You can find out more about the center by going to our blog at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. On that site, you will also be able to listen to archived previous segments of Health Styles. Today, my guest is Penny Cowan, the founder and executive director of the American Chronic Pain Association. Penny and I met a couple of weeks ago on a panel for women's health, and hearing her story and the need for the work that her and the people at the American Chronic Pain Association, as well as the thousands of people who benefit from the work of the American Chronic Pain Association, moved me to be sure to get an interview with her and learn more about their work and the kinds of options and the myriad ways that people, so many people living with pain, can be helped and help themselves and their families and their loved ones and their friends. So welcome to Health Styles, Penny Cowan, and I'm just looking forward to learning more from you as I did on our first encounter.
Thank you so much, Barbara. I appreciate it.
And I think it's helpful for people to hear, as the founder of the American Chronic Pain Association, I know that you comfortably have shared publicly your own personal story around living with chronic pain and why it was founded in 1980.
You know, for me, it's a very personal story, and it was this journey of, for many years, looking for a cure for my pain problem, which I had fibromyalgia, though at the time it took them 6 years to figure that out. And it was after going through a pain management program where several things happened. First of all, I realized I wasn't the only person in the world who had pain, because pain is so isolating. There were other people there, and it was amazing to me. It was very validating that I wasn't crazy and my pain was real. Secondly, what they taught me there, the coping skills, the self-management skills, and all of the help and positive reinforcement that the team gave me, really was just too good to keep to myself. I needed to tell someone else because I knew I wasn't the only person. But most importantly, it was because of my own fear of falling back into that role of patient, because so many other things had worked for me, but they only worked for a little while. So I wanted to make sure that I could maintain my wellness over the long term. So in the last 35 years, I've been working, you know, toward that goal, and you know, clearly I am able to function. And I think it's really important, though, to let people know right up front that the goal of pain management isn't to get rid of the pain. There may always be some level of pain. The goal is to improve the quality of your life, increase your function, and reduce your sense of suffering, which it can do.
Yes. You know, I don't know what the new name is, or I'm under the impression that fibromyalgia has been categorized as either a new name or a new kind of subgroup in terms of it being a healthcare issue.
Actually, when I was diagnosed, it was called fibrositis, and I'm not sure when it became fibromyalgia, but I think in recent years, the FDA has approved 3 medications for fibromyalgia, which I think elevated it to something that was more believable to the medical community, because it's one of those things that you can't really do any kind of a specific test for. It's more, you know, a process of elimination, and I think that's true for so many chronic pain issues, that, you know, there's just no definitive test to say, aha, this is what it is. So it's a number of different things, you know, and at one point they were saying, you know, if you have 11 of the 18 trigger points, then it's pretty clear that you have fibromyalgia, but it's much more complex. And I think what's really important is it's not just for the person, it's not just about the pain, it's what it does to your life, and that sort of that ripple effect out to family and friends. And I mean, the impact that chronic pain has on one individual is far more reaching than I think people realize.
And we know by the numbers, which one could also suggest are underrepresented when people talk about the significant percentage of people in the United States, if we just stay here and not talk about globally, but we can also talk about a global need for addressing pain and people living with pain, that the numbers are insurmountable and unacceptable. And I really respect the way that you describe the sort of prongs, or the three prongs, I believe it was three, of what it may mean. It may not mean pain-free, but it may mean managing it. It may mean how to live and be able to function and maintain as much as your life that you can while having levels of pain that really make those daily activities or that kind of joyful living very hard to do.
Right. I mean, there's the numbers of people in the United States alone is 100 million people. That's one out of every three. And the cost is over $600 billion a year in medical care, lost wages, workers' comp, all those factors play into it. And I think it's, you know, it is really important to realize that it's, you know, it's not just about the pain. It's about the impact it has. So, you know, there are many people that by the time they get to call us, unfortunately, we're sort of like the last stop for them, because there's always that hope that there's something out there that's going to cure them. But I think people with pain, many of them, come to that point where they just want, they want to be able to have a life again in spite of the pain. And their need and their desire to take an active role in their recovery process. So rather than being a passive patient, they really are ready to step up and be an active participant. But the missing element for so many people is that, but how do I do that? You can't just tell me to learn to live with it. Somebody's got to teach me how to do that. And that's what I experienced at the clinic, among many other things. And I think that's what's missing in so many. And that's very time-consuming for healthcare providers. So I think, you know, that's one of the places where the American Chronic Pain Association can begin to fill that gap, is educating on those self-management skills.
Let's talk about two things before we move to another subject. One, which is, you stated, sadly, too often people arrive at the American Chronic Pain Association site, which I want to mention. It's the letter THEACPA.org. That's www.theacpa.org. A very rich, a very well-researched, a very interactive, and many great resources on it. If you know someone, or you're a listener and you are someone living with any kind of chronic pain, I recommend strongly that you go to the site and begin to see the rich resources and ways to help you understand medications, treatments, pain management tools, pain awareness, different conditions, a myriad of conditions, and you will, I hope, find some path into, as my guest Penny Cowan, who's the founder and executive director of the American Chronic Pain Association, has said, which is, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not one medication that will necessarily cover all of your pain symptom, but it'll be opportunities for you to be supported very personally and very professionally to find ways that will help you manage, different types of tools that will help you manage. So why so late? Why can't this organization be one of the directions that people are given in the healthcare system, Penny?
You know, I've always said it's hard to get good news out.
It's hard to get good news out. Well, here we are on WBAI Health Size doing that
there you
today.
Go. But I think it's, you know, there's that expectation that any of us have that, you know, we want 100%. We want a cure. We want to be like we were before the pain started. We see that over and over again when we get colds and the flu and other things. You know, you break a bone, it heals, you're on your way again. And I think that chronic pain is so different, and it doesn't always get 100%. You may get 50, you may get 70, you may get 80, but that doesn't mean it's a failure. And I think healthcare providers have been lacking in education around how to help people manage pain. They've been taught to cure, not necessarily to heal the person. And there's a huge amount of healing that needs to take place in a person with pain so that they can actually, we actually have what we call our 10 steps from patient to person. And they're not, it's not a 10-step program that you have to do step 1, 2, and 3 in any order. The first two, though, are really important. The first one is accepting the pain, which is obviously the hardest thing to do. Most people think that means giving up. But what that means is that for today, realize that, okay, today pain is part of my life. Who knows what tomorrow is going to bring? But you have to stop at some point looking for that miracle cure. I mean, we've talked to people who have had 25 back surgeries, and they're looking for another one, thinking that will be the one to fix them. Mm-hmm. And there's a point. And then to take an active role, to get involved. They have to be, like I said, they cannot be a passive patient. They have to become an active participant in their health care and ask, okay, so what is my role? And when we go to a physical therapist, they may show you some exercises, but if we don't go home and follow through with that on a daily basis, it's not going to help us at all.
On your homepage, in addition to, as I mentioned, there are conditions, there's a condition tab, there are medication and treatments, there are pain management tools, and there's pain awareness. And then there is a let us guide you through the maze of pain. Will you describe briefly what that exercise is, and is that where you would recommend people start?
I would think that would be a very good place for them to start. And the reason that we began the maze of pain, because that's exactly how it feels when you're a person with pain. You get in this big maze, and you keep going from one dead end to another. So you need some kind of direction. So it is, the maze of pain is going to ask you a series of 3 questions to determine where best to take you on our website. There's so many things there that it would be hard to find it all. But if you can answer those questions, and you can stop after question 1 or 2 or 3 and do your search, but it's going to then collect all of the things that it thinks you need to begin your journey and to begin going through the maze, but having that guide, having the direction to help you. And then it's a matter of, again, you know, that person taking that active role and following through, whether it's looking at our pain log, where it's actually a graphical tool to help people communicate better with their provider about not just their pain level, but about the impact it has on their life, whether it's their stress, their exercise, their sleep, their appetite, their mood, you know, the fear of the pain, you know, are they taking their medication as prescribed, side effects, even constipation and sexual activity are on there. And they can actually go in and do that on a daily basis and begin to chart it. And the interesting thing about that is they may see their pain level may stay exactly the same, but their stress level has been reduced, they're sleeping better, maybe they became more active, they're not as isolated as they were. So again, it's not always about the pain, it's about quality of life and level of functioning.
I want to repeat that this maze that you would be taking, the information that is entered is not collected or reviewed by the American Chronic Pain Association. It's for your purpose and benefit solely. And I think that's a reassuring way of it being both for you. It's all about how to help you, and it is not data that is used by the association. And
right. I want to reinforce that as well. I mean, you have to create a password and a login, and we cannot. There's no way we can do that to get into it. But it's there for them to share with their healthcare professionals.
Great. You've mentioned in your response some of the other elements of being alive that are impacted by pain, and sexual ability, sexual desire, constipation, all of these things, which in addition to the pain can make for a really crappy day or not a crappy day if you're constipated, as well as perhaps impact your loving relationships where you are in an intimate relationship. And so people aren't often asked those questions in their healthcare encounter, are they?
No, they're not. And the interesting thing about the constipation, I mean, there's a lot of medications that cause constipation. It's medication-induced. So we actually have a video and another graphical tool to help people begin to start that conversation with their provider about whether or not they're having any issues with, and it's usually an opioid constipation issue, that, you know, so there's the video and there's the graphical tool that they don't have to actually bring the subject up. They can just, you know, hand them this graphical tool to start the conversation. And it really begins to let people realize that, you know, it's a part of the whole healthcare. And this is just one of the probable side effects to certain medications. And there's a lot of them that cause that.
And they can find out more about that on the site as well.
Correct. Or if they don't have access to the internet, actually,
yes.
And there are people who do not,
yes.
You know, we have a toll-free number, which is 800-533-3231. That's 800-533-3231. And we'll actually print some of the things out on our webpage and send them to people if they don't have access. We do that all the time.
Last, in March, at the Women's Healthcare Innovation and Leadership Conference panel that we were both on, you mentioned your work now also with the veteran community. Will you talk to that, and what are you doing with the veteran community, and how's their response been?
We actually have this project going called Vets in Pain, because we know that there's a huge amount of long-term chronic pain in that community, all of the folks. I mean, for me, it's an honor to go to a VA hospital and actually present a day-long presentation on pain management, how to communicate with your provider. You know, it's so meaningful to these vets to realize that someone cares enough to begin to, don't tell me to learn to lift up, but begin to teach me how to do that. So we've been doing this program probably for about we're in our fourth year now. We've gone through to 45 VAs where we do a day-long presentation. The last part of that presentation is actually teaching them how to do a peer-led support group. We have a workbook, the facilitator guide, that's going to take them step-by-step on how to do that. And so the presentation actually goes through that workbook with them. And we continue to support our facilitators ongoing. And that's where that community comes in, especially for veterans or anyone else with pain, is that, you know, they have a group where they can go and really share their feelings. And actually, in our groups, we don't talk about physical symptoms. I mean, everybody's there because they have pain. The question is, how do I live with this? You know, what are some of the issues that come up with? So, you know, the Vets in Pain and the VA has been very supportive of us continuing to do these programs. So I have another, I think, six or eight of them scheduled already this year that I'll be doing.
And you mentioned that you've already done 45 of them?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what are they, all different age groups of veterans? Are they some of our younger vets returning from our recent Afghanistan, Iraq, and other parts of the world?
Yeah, I think at one of them, and I can't remember which one it was, I actually had a World War II veteran, mm-hmm. an older adult, but most of them either Vietnam, from Korean War, mm-hmm. and then the Gulf War, and then the Iraq and Afghanistan. Those are the ones that we see now, the Gulf. I mean, it's across the board. And interestingly enough, it's not just men, it's the women too. And
yes.
I think we tend to forget that there are a lot of women in service in our country that actually are out there on the front lines with the men now. And, they deal with the same kinds of issues as the men do.
I had the privilege of being an advisor on a film called When Women Come Marching Home. And it was a documentary made about the issue of our women veterans who are returning to healthcare needs, as well as housing needs and employment needs, not unlike uh-huh. all of our veterans, but in particular how the veteran system has not really been adequately responding to specific needs that are impacting women. And I'm sure that although pain has, as you said, is so individualistic, that for women to have those kinds of healthcare needs met, and it not yet being reflected as a gendered specific healthcare system in the VA system, that all kinds of issues have arisen for those women seeking care.
I mean, but the VA is really, really trying. I mean, they're focusing a lot more on the more balanced approach to pain management. In other words, what are all of the components of pain management, both for men and women? And they really are trying. I know there's a couple of them where they actually have women groups. You know, women that come together, they hold the group, whether it's through social service or even through a nurse that will do this for them.
So when
on some of the other issues that they're dealing with.
When you talk about, Penny, I know that there is probably more than we have enough time in today's segment to talk about some of the pain management tools that are also reflected and guided on your site. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about some of them and which ones that you have found effective in your own use.
I actually have applied them all to my daily living. I mean, that's why the reason I started this is to maintain my own wellness, so I've really incorporated them all. But I think, like I talked about the first two, which is the acceptance and getting involved. But, I mean, we talk about setting personal priorities, you know, because there's so many things that we let go over a long period of time because of the pain that it just becomes overwhelming. So we need a starting point. So we talk about how to really recognize and determine what your priorities are, and then to set realistic goals for yourself and nail them down to small, manageable steps. I think what most people don't understand is that pain is not 100% constant, the same level all the time. People do have good days and bad days. And the problem is they don't listen to their bodies. And so on good days, they do far too much rather than pacing themselves, you know, narrowing it down to small, manageable steps. So they might actually have a good day the next day. We teach them their basic rights. I mean, we need to empower them. I think pain takes away a certain amount of takes a lot of our self-esteem away. And so we need to give that back to them by empowering them with these basic rights, you know, that they have the right to be treated with dignity and respect. They have the right to stop and think before they respond. They have the right to change their mind. They have the right to do less than humanly possible. They have the right to make mistakes. All of those, they're key to people. We talk about the impact that our feelings and emotions have on our pain level. I mean, we can't separate our mind and body, so it's really important not to ignore the emotional part of our being as well as the physical part. We talk about relaxation, you know, learning how to manage stress, again, listening to your body when you hear that first ouch instead of pushing forward, you know, thinking, okay, I can do more, to begin to just learn how you can stop. Take 5 minutes. We actually have a 5-minute relaxation video and text right on our webpage. They can just go in. It's free. Click on it. Lay down for 5 minutes. Listen to it. You know, it's really a way to help people begin to redirect their attention off of their pain and onto something else. And we talk about exercising, you know, and this is something that they absolutely need to talk with their healthcare provider about. And you know, we can't tell people what is a good exercise for them to do, but we do have, and we have workbooks. One of them is called From Patient to Person, First Steps, and there's actually illustrated some mild stretching exercises in there, but they're in there so they can take it to their healthcare provider and ask them, which of these am I capable of doing? And then encouraging them to start out slow, not to try to do them all at once and set themselves up for failure. And we talk about our attitude toward, you know, instead of looking at what we can't do anymore and all of our disabilities, I want to know what can we still do? Mm-hmm. A lot of times we have to redefine ourselves because of the pain, and that's not always a bad thing. And then obviously, you know, the outlook, that total, you know, sharing and outreach to other people. And I think that's, you know, that's where I am right now, is the outreach. That was a very quick overview some of the basics.
Of some of the basics, of course. And you're helping others as a form of both incredible advocacy. I know that you speak to the fact that pain is still unfortunately ignored, too ignored. The level of research in the area has gotten better, but still not efficient or sufficient. And just briefly, because I know that the media has focused a lot on the abuse of opioids rather than pain management, What balance is missing from that conversation in the media? What about the people who are successfully using opioids to help manage their pain and are not abusing it? Is that story being told?
Not too much. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, it's always if one person does something wrong, then obviously anybody else can do it too. And so we always look at the negative instead of perhaps the positive. I mean, opioids can be a part of the treatment. But again, that's between the person and their provider. But I think it goes more back almost to expectation. And what I mean by that is we expect that one quick fix. And I know I said this when I was on the panel. Mm-hmm. We'd like to describe a person with pain like a car, except their car has four flat tires. Our expectation is all I need is that one medication and I'm good to go. And that's where people tend to stop. The problem is it only puts air in one of our tires. And it may be giving us the 20 or 30% that it's meant to. That's good. Leave that there and ask ourselves, what else do we need? And that's where the balanced approach comes in. For every person, it's going to be different, whether it's physical therapy, it may be, you know, some counseling, it can be acupuncture, it can be a variety of different modalities. And when we get all four tires filled, it's our job to maintain our car. Mm-hmm. You don't take it back to the dealer and say, wash my window, fill her up. That's mm-hmm. your job. If something goes wrong, we take it in for a checkup. So I think, you know, the balanced approach is we keep focusing on that one tire and that one issue of opioids, when in fact that's only a small piece, a part of the bigger picture of pain management. And they're not appropriate for everyone. Mm. But, you know, it's individualized just like everything else. There's not a one-size-fits-all way to treat anybody. Because each of us are so unique and special. And that's why it's important for that person with pain to take the active role, to be an active participant, to have a meaningful conversation with their provider. And again, that's why we have all the graphical tools on our webpage to help do that in the short amount of time that we have.
Another population that is often missing in the conversation about chronic pain are children. And you've also created resources for parents and guardians and providers to better understand approaching pain management for children. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And it's called Growing Pains. It's mm-hmm. growingpains.org. And it's a site designed specifically for kids. And they enter this site through their feelings. And there's this little tree on the one side. So all these leaves are sort of hanging, and each leaf is a different feeling word. So they can choose how they feel. And it's amazing, you know, instead of asking you about your pain, we're asking them, how do they feel? You know, and we're getting, they can add words. But each of those feelings are going to take them through a number of different things to teach them not only about the feelings and not that they're isolated or alone, that there's other kids out there, but all of the other coping skills. You know, when they come in, when they first enter the site, they can, you know, select their avatar, they can, you know, dress it, put the hair on it, mm-hmm. and now we've added a second phase where they can actually start to earn points because they can journal, whether they share it with, you know, others and make it public or just keep their own personal journal. I mean, it's a site for kids because it's hard to let them know that they're not alone. I mean, it's really hard being a teenager growing up as a kid. It's even harder when you're dealing with a pain problem.
Yeah. Tell us the name of that site one more time.
It's growingpains.org. Hmm. And there's also a site specifically for vets. It's called vetsinpain.org. So there's two separate sites for those two populations, the vets and for kids in pain.
All right. So you can Vets in Pain and Growing Pains are the two other sites.org that are focusing very specifically on the needs of those two populations.
Correct.
And the American Chronic Pain Association is the acpa.org for more information. We have just a couple of minutes left here, Penny, and I wanted to, you know, go back to your work and where you hope things go. Where are the needs? Where are the holes that you're working with others and other associations? I know you collaborate with other professional organizations and other organizations that are also dealing with people living with pain or organizations of people who need your advice around how to manage that. So where do you want your organization to go, or what are the areas that you will be continuing to do more work towards?
We have a long list, actually, but a couple things. And you mentioned, though, that we're reaching out and working with professional organizations. We are doing the public education event in Palm Springs, California, on May 13th. And there's a poster on our webpage. You can learn more about that. But I think for me, one of the most important things is to catch people before they fall, like I call, all the way down the rabbit hole. Mm. In other words, when that pain initially begins, after it's gone on for more than 3 months, to begin to help people learn how to manage that pain before we become so deconditioned. That's the problem with people with pain. It's that journey from that person into that person with chronic pain that I want to sort of revert back to, you know, catching more of the acute pain problems, just with the back pain. Mm-hmm. You know, the old adage of just lay down and you know, take rest for a few days and it'll get better is the wrong advice. You know, you have to stay more active. Laying down is only going to decondition us more. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just, you know, reaching out and really reaching people at a much earlier stage before they are so deconditioned and so hopeless that some people just give up. And I don't want them to give up, because there is hope.
I want to thank Penny Cowan, founder and executive director of the American Chronic Pain Association. You can find out more about her and the work that they are doing on their site. The American Chronic Pain Association can be found online at theacpa.org. You can also find out more about children living and adolescents living with pain at growingpains.org. And finally, the work with our veterans, and that's vetsinpain.org. Thank you for doing the work that you do, Penny Cowan, and thank you for joining me today on Health Styles.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.